All right, so hey, what a fantastic series of lessons this has been. I'm really honored to close out the semester, the set of series here today, with a study of the book and the person of Job. So from Barnabas to Daniel to John to Joseph to David to Hezekiah to Noah, and now Job, the lessons and the takeaways from these amazing Bible leaders are not limited. And I tell you, when Kurt Cruz sent out an email and was asking for men to lead this series, I didn't see the email probably for several hours later, and I saw a bunch of replies, and I said, oh no, my choice is going to be taken, right? So I was very happy when I was looking down and seeing what everybody chose. I really had in mind, I really wanted to study Job today. So we saved Job for last, certainly not best, but very, very happy that he made the list. So why Job? Right, so I think ever since I was a kid, I had a fascination with this story, and my fascination has been renewed after studying it again in depth as an adult. Job is an up-and-down story. It's a hot-and-cold story. It's a happy and sad story. It really depends on what part of the book you're reading, how much and how deep you study it. You know, Job's calling to persevere through the various provocations and aggravations and hassles that the devil, Satan, sends his way is really nothing short of amazing. So let's start with something that's been on my mind lately, baseball. So stayed up a little bit too late probably last night watching the Miami Marlins clinch a playoff berth for the first time in 20 years, but that's actually not why baseball is on my mind, although I am excited for the Marlins. So youth baseball. So my oldest son, Madden, is doing travel ball for the first time, U9 travel ball. Started off as a parent in the stands, and somehow I've found my way out to the field as a coach. So it's always funny how that happens. You think you're taking a season off, and then you get asked to come and help. So we're only days away from the major league playoffs starting. I got multiple practices and games a week. So you're wondering, who's this guy? Is it anybody know? Anybody a San Francisco Giants fan? Anybody a Toronto Blue Jays fan? Okay, well, he's only played for two teams. So on April 22nd, 2018, this guy, this Giants first baseman, Brandon Belt, broke an MLB record, and nobody knew it happened. It happened. He finished his at-bat. Nobody was talking about it. So Brandon Belt, back a couple years ago, before there was a pitch clock, before the game was sped up and is now about a half an hour faster, he had an at-bat that consisted of 21 pitches. And you might be thinking, okay, that's not that many. I could take 21 pitches. So we ended that at-bat in a flyout. So the average at-bat these days, and probably even back then, average at-bat was 2 to 3 minutes. You get up, you take 5 or 6 pitches, you either strike out, you take a walk, you get a hit. Right, so 21 pitches in that at-bat. And I'll tell you, as a baseball coach, as a coach in general, there's almost nothing more fulfilling than seeing a kid, especially a kid, get up there and go down 0-1, 1-2, and not let his head hang, and not drop and say, I'm behind the count, this isn't going to be a very good at-bat for me, right? Seeing an at-bat get extended by a batter who refuses to get up. So what did Brandon Belt's at-bat look like? Well, he started off 0-1. He fouled one back over third base. Not a great start, right? He then took a ball, okay? We're battling back. We're getting back ahead of the count. We're trying. He then swung looking. He swung at a ball, missed it. So he's down 1-2, right? He's toast. He's behind the count, 1-2. What's he going to do? He then starts fouling pitches off. So he fouls pitch number 4, number 5. He takes a ball with number 6. So for those keeping track at home, we're at 2-2, right? It's okay. He's gotten back a little bit. He fouls another one off. He stays 2-2. He fouls another one off. He finally gets that ball. Okay, 3-2. Now I got to protect the plate. Pitches 10 through 21, he fouled off. So 11 or 12 straight pitches. And I wish the story ended better. He flied out to right field. But that record was broken that day, and even the announcers weren't sure. How long is the longest at bat, right? So this is nothing really more to just share with you a story, a 13-minute story of perseverance. 13-minute, and if this at-bat happened in today's game, it was probably a 5 to 6 minute story of perseverance. So we're going to stay on the baseball theme, and maybe a player that folks more recognize, not only maybe just the face on the left side of that screen, but the back of the jersey there, Cal Ripken Jr. So on September 6, 1995, Mr. Ripken Jr. broke Lou Gehrig's record that was set back in 1925 for most continuous games played without a miss. So the record he broke, you see it there, 2,131 straight games. And that streak would actually continue up to 2,632 games about 3 years later in 1998. So that's why they call Cal Ripken Jr. the Iron Man, right? Who demonstrated an incredible feat of perseverance over a 16-year stretch, which started back in 1982. So we've seen a baseball feat of perseverance that lasted 13 minutes, and we've seen one now that has lasted 16 years. So for the non-baseball enthusiasts, most of you are saying, okay, he's done with the baseball stuff. I don't really like baseball, especially coming off a college football day yesterday, right? What about some household names? Thomas Edison struggled through 1,000 ways that he couldn't build a light bulb, right? And even our small children, many of our small children down this hallway would recognize the name Edison. Henry Ford. Did you know Henry Ford went bankrupt multiple times? He was left penniless, failed multiple ventures before innovating the assembly line. I think we know his success, right? I could look out in this parking lot and probably a quarter of the cars out there are Ford vehicles. It's another household name, Steven Spielberg, rejected 3 times by the USC College of Theater, Film, and Television. Pursued directing without a degree. Said, I'm going to try it. And there are probably very few of us in this room who couldn't name at least one famous Steven Spielberg movie. Another household name, Elvis Presley, was fired by the manager of Nashville's Grand Ole Opry after one show. You know what he was told? You ain't going nowhere, son. You ought to go back to driving a truck. You can now call him the king. And then finally, I'm going to test you on this one. Maybe this isn't quite as household of a name as you might think. Some are saying, how could it not be? So before becoming Colonel Sanders, right, determined Harlan submitted his now world-famous fried chicken recipe to over 1,000 restaurants before finding a buyer. And now what do we say? It's finger-looking good, right? Okay, what about a few names more appropriate for this Bible class? Jeremiah continued over and over to demonstrate his faithfulness by sharing God's revelations to a wicked nation. Next one's maybe more obvious, right? Who struggled more in the New Testament than Paul? He went from, of course, killing Christians to being one himself. Repeatedly imprisoned, flogged, shipwrecked, lashed, stoned, driven out of town, abandoned. Love 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7 through 10, if you can follow along here. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not us. This is Paul speaking. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. The persistent widow has her own story, right? Luke chapter 18, she wore that judge down so much and taught us that when we passionately cry out to God, he hears us. That story teaches us in verse 1 to, quote, always pray and not lose heart. Last two here, Joseph, another obvious one, overcomes temptation, wrongly charged and placed in prison, then was betrayed by his jealous brothers. Even in the hardest times, Joseph did not compromise his character to get ahead. And finally, I hope you would hold me accountable if I didn't have this name on this list. It's Jesus himself, the epitome of perseverance. I think that's a story that speaks for itself. And I'll end with this one for now. I hope everybody's saying, who is Autumn Veach? I have never heard that name, and neither had I. Right? A story of incredible nature. So 2015, the year's 2015, 16-year-old Autumn Veach was forced to journey for 3 days in the Washington State wilderness after being the lone survivor in a deadly plane crash. That plane crashed over the very thick forested woods of the Cascades Mountains in Washington. Both of her grandparents were killed in that plane crash. She persevered for 3 days without food, water, or shelter. She was finally rescued. So we come to the story of Job. Finally got here. 11 minutes in, we're going to talk about Job. A really fascinating 42 chapters of beautiful poetic language. So when I think of Job, I think of many themes, and many of these we'll discuss later. But I also think about the words that we've already said today. Perseverance, steadfastness, resolve, tenacity, determination, patience, endurance, and grit. We'll see all these characteristics of Job on full display as we study the book a little further. But let me pivot for one moment. It's a tough question to ask, and it's a tough question to answer. Have you suffered? Rhetorically, of course, I think the answer resoundingly from everybody in this room is, of course. But we've all suffered probably in different ways. We're human, right? Many of us suffer, unfortunately, to much deeper levels than others. What I've learned in my short time is that turmoil comes in all shapes and sizes. A quick anecdote, I began coming to this church when I was 10 years old, and I sat over here, fourth, fifth grade. And I remember Sunday after Sunday, Wednesday after Wednesday, hearing the announcements. And there was a particular person, a particular family, who I felt like every week that name was always mentioned. And this didn't go on for days or weeks. This went on for years, that every time there was an announcement, right? We tend to think of the announcements as usually a little bit more bad news than good news, but every time there's some good news, we celebrate. And I just remember my childhood being filled with these stories of this individual and his family just going after turmoil, whether it was physical, it was mental, it was psychological. And it really helped at a young age teach me empathy and introspection. I often ask myself in my own head over here as a young kid, why him? Why again? Not that I ever thought, why can't it be somebody else? But in some ways, why does it have to be this family every week, every month, every year? And so every time I heard about yet another unfortunate event during those announcements, I started to ask myself the question that you ask once you read Job of why? Why? And we'll dive a little bit into that today. And what I'll leave you with is I've always looked at challenges and turmoil and despair as a storm, right? And we've gone through a few storms here recently. So I think of it as this way. Each and every one of us in this room is either in one of three places, right? We're either in the midst of a storm. You don't know you are sometimes until you look back on it. You've either just gotten out of a storm, or you're just going to go about to go into a storm. And so what's beautiful and a little bit sad about the story of Job is it really encompasses all three facets of us being in the midst of a storm. So finally, a few questions, rhetorical questions, just to get you thinking. I think what you'll see with some of these questions is you can resoundingly shake your head, absolutely, the answer to that is yes. And others, you might say, it's a little bit tougher to answer. We could probably have an entire series or entire lesson on some of these questions. So is the book of Job a feel-good story? Is it a story of grief and loss, or is it a story of hope and promise, or is it both? Why do the righteous suffer? Are we punished for unknown sin? How can a just God allow evil and suffering in the world? Does God remain faithful even during the most appalling circumstances? Is Satan limited in his power when it comes to our suffering? Does God always make it clear why we suffer? How should we treat our friends when they're suffering? Is God always in control? Is the Lord compassionate and merciful? So let's dive a little bit. First, what do we know about the book of Job? And that's actually a question I want to hear a couple answers to. What do we know about the book of Job? Okay. Oldest book. Many believe that. Yes, sir. 10 children. 10 children, okay. Anybody know the mix? Male and female? 7 and 3? Okay, anything else? So it's Old Testament. We'll start off easy between the books of Esther and Psalms. It's the 18th book of the Bible, at least in the order that we can pick up a Bible and look at it. 42 chapters, just over 1,000 verses, just over 10,000 words. Right, so we have a prologue, first chapter or two of the book of Job, written in very plain or what they call prose language. And then we have the poetic dialogue. So we have something like 40 chapters of really beautiful, and in some ways aggravating, and we'll see why, but very beautiful language describing the majesty of God. And those dialogues are really between six different people, six different entities, right? You have Job, of course. You have Job's three friends. You have Elihu, who is interested, introduced toward the tail end of the book. And then, of course, God gets involved and God interjects. And then, of course, you have a prologue, which very closely mirrors the epilogue at the very end, very closely mirrors the prologue at the beginning to really summarize. What did we just read? What is the outcome of the story? So the author, do we know? Not really, right? Some say Moses, others say Job, some say a combination. For the purposes of our Christian walk and the lessons that we can draw and apply to our lives from Job, it doesn't matter. It's one of five poetical books. So, quiz time, what are the other four? Psalms? Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, I think we met, maybe you said it. Proverbs. So the book of Job was likely written during Genesis, right? So there's a lot of very clear evidence that this was a book during the patriarchal age, before, somewhere from before the law of Moses to about 400 BC. So how do we know? So first of all, we can look at the lifespan. How long did Job live? About 200 years. We know that he lived 140 years after his suffering, which puts you right in the lifespan area of several other prominent patriarchal characters. Anybody remember how old Abraham was when he died? Older than us, but not really old. Anybody? He was 175 when he died, and Moses was 120. So it puts him right in that area. What about wealth? What do we know about Job's wealth? Did it talk about all the silver and gold and gems that Job had? No. It talked about, a little bit boring to me, but maybe not so much back then, talked about his livestock, right? How many oxen? How many donkeys? He also had priestly duties. Right, so the book talks about the fact that he offers sacrifices on behalf of his children, on behalf of himself. And then maybe the clearest evidence, there's no reference in this book to Israel, any exodus from Egypt, the Mosaic Law, or the tabernacle. And as we said earlier, many believe it is the earliest recorded book of the Bible. Okay, what about the man? We talked a little bit about the book. What about the man? Where is he from? Yua? Uz? The land of Uz, adjacent to the land of Midian. What do we know about his character? Very righteous. Also rich. Not always two words that come together, right? He feared God and he shunned evil. And I love the word shunned, I underline it. It's not a word that we teach our kids these days, right? It's not a word you'll hear out in Publix on the street, but such a powerful word to me, to blot out, to ignore, to put away, to not even think about it, right? We talked about his 10 children, and I put in here parentheses, right? 10 children twice. We'll talk a little bit about that later. We talked about his riches. Look at that. It's a big farm, right? I don't know how you handle all those unless you have a lot of help. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen. How many oxen is that? How many oxen in a yoke? Two. 500 donkeys and many servants, as verse 3. What's beautiful in chapter 42, right, is that we learn he was blessed The latter days of Job were even more blessed than the beginning. We also know that this man was great. He was the greatest of the people of the East. Verse 3. His greatest asset, we said it earlier, his righteousness, his faith. And the Bible is not shy to exclaim that over and over. And unfortunately, throughout the book, we know he suffered very, very greatly. Job is also mentioned in two other books. He's mentioned in Ezekiel, Old Testament, and he's mentioned in James, New Testament. In Ezekiel chapter 14, it's very beautiful that Job is mentioned as a part of Ezekiel chapter 14 with the men Noah and Daniel. Why is he mentioned in Ezekiel chapter 14? Not just for the righteousness. The context of this verse is that they were men who saved others. Right? So we think about Noah. He spared his family through his righteousness, through his faith. What about Daniel? We know that he saved his companions as a part of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And then, of course, when you think of Job, you may not really think about the part of the story where Job saved lives. Whose lives did he save? Who did God spare at the very end of the book of Job? Those friends, right? Oh, those friends. We're going to talk about those friends here in a few minutes. Job probably didn't have to do that. But we know that God spared those friends after Job did one very powerful but simple thing. And what was that? Job repented. Job repented and he prayed for those friends. And then James chapter 5, verse 11 also mentions Job. This is probably maybe more of a common verse that we know Job is mentioned in. It says, have you heard of the steadfastness of Job? Going back to that resilience, going back to that perseverance. I love the word steadfastness. Again, not a word that our kids outside of these walls have probably heard. And you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. So we're going to dive very quickly, and we're probably going to skip a lot of the middle content I've prepared just so we can make sure we can tie this all at the end. So chapter 1 is a very important chapter in the book of Job, right? It talks about Job's prosperity, and it begins the explanation of how Job goes through multiple calamities. So Job is introduced. We know that God allows Satan to test Job. What does it say? And if you're not in Job, suggest you get there. We're going to be spending quite a bit of time there. What does verse 8 say about Job? Have you considered my servant that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man? Did Job volunteer for this? You know what we call this in the corporate world? He didn't volunteer. He was voluntold. You ever been voluntold? Hey, it feels like I'm asking you to do something, but I'm not really asking. I'm telling. Right? So this is an example of an honor. Right? That Job out of the entire world, the entire earth, would consider a man like Job. Anytime I've been presented with an opportunity at work, it doesn't always feel like I get a choice. Although at the end of the day, you do, right? But this is we're presenting something to you and we expect you to take it, right? So Job, it's coming. Be ready for it. You don't really have a choice. So boundaries are set. What do we mean by this? So Job is volunteered, whichever way you want to go. Boundaries are set. What do we mean by boundaries are set? There were some limits. And what was the big limit on the table here? Don't lay your hands on his person. Please don't kill him. And it probably wasn't a please don't kill him. It was a hey, you're not going to kill him, right? This is God talking. So only against him do not stretch out your hand, we read in verse 12. So then Satan quickly gets to work. I mean quickly, right? These four messengers come. Were these good messengers? Well, they were probably good messengers. Do they have a good message? So when somebody comes to your house with a message, what are you hoping? Whew, I hope there's some good news coming. And what was the case in all four of these messengers? And you'd probably consider as each one came, the news got what? Got a little bit worse. So we read verse 14, verse 16, verse 17, verse 18. These messengers come. First three verses after these messengers come, we learn what? Possessions are gone. Destroyed. Everything you just read about in those prior verses, they're gone. And then, of course, what we all dread as parents, if anybody who has children, that messenger comes and says, family's gone. We talked about those 10 children. How many were lost? All of them. Not one left. And then between verses 20 and 22, Job reacts. Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. Why did Job shave his head? Why do we think Job shaved his head? It was a symbol of submission. Okay. Say that louder. Humility. There's three theories, and I tend to think none of them are probably wrong. So first of all, he's in extreme mourning. Second of all, as we talked about, it was an act of repentance. Job at this point knows, I must have done something wrong. I may not know what it is, but I am going to do what I need to do to show humility, to get down on my knees, and to figure out why this is happening to me. Right? This was to show he was sorry. And then finally, what do we see a lot in the Old Testament? Hair is a symbol of what? Status, strength, right? And so what Job is doing here is he's lowering himself. He's humbling himself to a much lower status. So in chapter 2, Job's health is attacked. We're going to move a little bit quicker here. So God offers Job up yet again, a second time. And of course, what does Satan do? Absolutely. Let's try this again. Let's go a little bit deeper. I love chapter 2, verse 3. God says this to Satan. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me. So what comes? Those sores. Were those little mosquito bites? Most likely not. Loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Here's where the story really starts to get emotional, beyond the physical, right? Job's wife, biggest support system in the world, right? How does Job's wife react?
Job lost 10 children and everything killed. So did his wife. Right, so we give her a rough time. She didn't stand by her man.
Yep. Yeah, it's something that's probably not discussed enough, but Tracy has a wonderful point. This wasn't just happening to Job. Now, some of the things, some of the physical, were happening to Job. But Job's wife experienced these same losses, and we don't know the dynamic of that family. And
but it's a great lesson. Job faced his tragedy really well, and she did not.
It's a great point. So, Job's wife, first instinct, it's there in verse 9, curse God and die. Did we ever hear Job say that throughout the book? Nothing even close, right? Verse 10, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He started to accept this adversity, but he didn't just accept it and walk away and say, okay, this is done, right? He dove. He's getting emotional. He's under turmoil. He's trying to understand, why is this happening to me? How can I fix this? Let me get answers from God. So let's talk about Job's friends. I'll tell you, when I reread these verses as a part of this study, I guess I'd read this before, but I was kind of shocked, because what's your first instinct of Job's friends? So I'm going to flash, make sure I stop at the right one here. I put the word incredible. You said the first response was really great. I wrote the word incredible here. I thought it was incredible. The friends did exactly what you would hope friends would do. They came from very far, each from their own place, to come and support Job. They showed him sympathy. They comforted him. They raised their voices and wept. They sat with him on the ground for 7 days and 7 nights with a lot of dialogue, right? A lot of back and forth. No, they didn't say a word. Right? No one spoke a word to him. They saw that his suffering was very great. This is exactly what I want to have happen. People to come and comfort. And what do you need? Do you need me to talk? Do you need me to be quiet? I'll be whatever you need me to be. An incredible, incredible first response. And if you didn't know anything else about the book of Job, you would not think it was about to go down the path that it did. So chapter 3, Job curses the day of his birth. This chapter marks the beginning of what we talked about earlier, the poetic dialogues. He questions, why must he endure such suffering? So I love verse 11. I don't love it from the fact that it's very graphic, but it tells you about Job's mental state. Right? Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb, and expire? Job's heart was crushed. For him to use some of this language in chapter 3, he's truly trying to understand why this is happening to him. I am not at ease, nor I am quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes, verse 26. So chapters 4 and 5, here we go. Friend number 1, Eliphaz, the first dialogue, suggests that Job's suffering must be a result of some sin. Nobody knows at this point. Is this sin from his children? Is this something Job did? And talk about theories. So wild theories and accusations come out from these friends throughout this book. So it starts with compliments. It describes a vision that Eliphaz has. And then he starts to say, hey, you need to take care of this. You need to get some advice from God. Seek God. Figure out what you did because you definitely did something. This isn't just happening because you're an upright and just man. He says in verse 17, blessed is the one who God reproves. Therefore, despise not the discipline, O the Almighty. Basically, you need to take this discipline and figure out how not to let this happen again. Right? So those really supportive friends, the tides are starting to turn here. So Job responds, of course. Job defends his anguish. He questions what he does and did himself. And he sees death as imminent. He basically is saying, I might as well be dead. There's nothing worse than what I've gone through. I know it's coming. This is what Job is feeling at the time. So that I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones. Verse 15. Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. Verse 21. And here comes Bildad, chapter 8, first dialogue. Again, new friend coming to the table. What do you have to offer? Well, Job, you need to go repent. You need to do it. You need to cover all your bases here. You need to go repent for yourself, and you need to go repent for your children. Job responds, of course. So what we're going to see is this theme. It is many, many, many chapters of back and forth. Job shows his righteousness and his humility in a lot of ways throughout these dialogues, but he also shows some anger and disgust. Job fluctuates a lot through these verses. So Job brags about God and questions how a person can even argue with him. And then he also pleads with God for reverence and desperation. Chapters 11 through 13. This is now Zophar's first dialogue, and he responds to Job, and then Job responds again with resolve. So Zophar accuses Job of lying and suggests that he deserves even worse than he got. Can you imagine what Job has already gone through? And his friends are saying, hey, that's not enough. More should be coming to you. And by the way, I'm accusing you of lying, and I don't even know what you lied about. But you must have. You must have done something. Job defends himself in some really beautiful language in these chapters. He explores the mysteries of God. Verse 13, with God are wisdom and might. He has counsel and understanding. He's holding firm, he's holding fast to that faith in God. So we're going to blast through a lot of the middle dialogue here. So chapters 14 through 31, the friends continue to, what I put here is the word debate. So as I'm reading this and I'm restudying this, it felt like a debate. It felt like this was I know there's political debates going on that I certainly have not been watching purposefully. But it feels like this was a debate stage. In a lot of ways that you see when Elihu comes in later, it kind of felt like one. This was in a public setting. Others were watching this and listening to these words. So I'm going to just skip through these pretty quickly. And I want to stop at a few of them. Chapter 16. Job calls his friends miserable comforters. And he also says, God has worn me out. Job describes his torment. He expresses hope in seeing God. So again, a lot of back and forth. He's demonstrating his righteousness. He's holding fast to his faith. But at the same time, he's frustrated. He's angry. He's seeking answers. He's defending himself in a lot of ways, although he also takes time to defend God. A lot of Job's responses to his friends are, hey, I'm here to defend myself. You can't talk to me and make these accusations, and I'm just going to sit here and listen to it. And then chapter 22, the friends, you know, they're pretty shallow, right? And if you read chapter 22, one of the friends, Eliphaz, accuses Job of oppressing the poor. And it goes through all these examples of, you must have done this, you must have not clothed those without clothes and fed those without food. And it's all conjecture. It's all hypothesis. There's no basis of fact. This is what must be going on because you're being punished so hard. Imagine yourself in that position and your best friend has flown across the country to come and support you. And this is the treatment you get. It's incredibly sad. So in these chapters, we see Eliphaz responds for a second time, Bildad responds for a second time, Zophar a second time, Eliphaz responds a third time, and Bildad responds a third time. So again, moving pretty quickly through chapters 23 through 31, I'll just stop on a few. Chapter 26 is another one I would star and say, you know, in these verses, Job beautifully describes God's majesty through creation, right? If we had time to read these verses, I wish we did, but really, really beautiful accounts of Job showing his humility. And then finally, in chapter 31, Job makes that final declaration and invites God to judge him. So Elihu comes in. Chapter 32, which is a little strange. This is a character we hadn't read about. There was no introduction, chapter 1, chapter 2, in that prologue. Who's Elihu? Do we know who Elihu is? We know he was a character not previously mentioned. We know that he intervenes and shows his criticism not only of Job, but especially of the three friends. It says multiple times that Elihu burned with anger. It says it three times throughout these few chapters. He burned with anger. What we know about Elihu is he was around for this back and forth, this debate, as I called it. He was there. And boy, was the rage filling up in his belly. So he was younger. He made that very clear that he sat back and waited. And he said, I'm not going to get involved until there is a pause in this conversation. And it's very clear and rereading these chapters that this dialogue back and forth, there weren't minutes and hours and days between these dialogues. This was rapid fire. This was debate stage material without the commercial breaks. Right? And Elihu finally comes in when the verses say, hey, Job and Job's friends didn't have anything else to say. They took a break. And Elihu steps in and says, my turn. And Elihu piles on. He piles on to the friends. He piles on to Job. So chapter 38 and 39, and really the beginning of chapter 40, the Lord answers Job. So in these verses, we won't have time to explore them, unfortunately. God affirms, of course, his own sovereignty and majesty and emphasizes the creation account. So what Job did earlier, kind of going back to creation, showing that humility, God comes in and asks such powerful questions. And I've broadcasted a few here just for you to reread and say, if God asks you these questions, how would you answer them? I'll tell you what, you wouldn't. You wouldn't have a way to. And if you did, I'd probably be a little bit scared of your response, right? Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? And of course, this is all summarized in verse 4. Where were you, Job, when I, God, laid the foundation of the earth. Last few chapters of this wonderful book, Job humbles himself, and then God presents a challenge. Job declares silence. Job puts his hands up and says, I'm done. There's nothing more that I can do. I can't convince these friends. I can't make sense of this. And I certainly am not going to curse God and die, as we saw earlier with the language with Job's wife. Some really cool verses of the Bible are in chapters 40, right? So we learn about Behemoth, and then a really, really interesting description of Leviathan. I think a deeper description of Leviathan than Behemoth, right? What God says about Behemoth and his account of creation is that his bones are tubes of bronze. In describing Leviathan, terror danced before him. And then we finally get to the end of the story. Job confesses and repents. He displays his sincere humility. Chapter 42, verse 3. These are the last words of Job. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. I had always heard, but I didn't have the resolution, the perseverance to see you with my eyes. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. And of course, what we talked about earlier, God comes in and very sternly admonishes those friends, but forgives Job. So very interesting, the language we talked about earlier that Elihu used, my anger burned against them, my anger burned against them, my anger burned against them. God uses the same language about the friends in verse 7 of chapter 42. In verse 8, not to deal with you according to your folly. And then finally, in verse 9, the Lord accepted Job's prayer. Summarizing Job's response is there at the very bottom of this slide in chapter 42, verse 3. Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. So what's the outcome here? The Lord restores Job's fortunes. And I love this part. He didn't just restore those fortunes. Something had to happen first. When he had prayed for his friends, everything that Job went through, everything those friends did to pile on, and his fortunes would not have been restored had he not prayed for those friends. And what we talked about in those other references in the Bible to Job, Ezekiel and James, he spared their life. God gave Job twice as much as he had before. Look at these astounding numbers. I didn't know what to do with 7,000 sheep. What do you do with 14,000 sheep? 6,000 camels, now 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys. Bible doesn't indicate what happens to those servants, right? Does he have many, many servants now? Twice as many servants? Pretty sure with that many animals, he had quite a few servants. And how this story ends is beautiful. Just as those friends came to him and were supportive, what the Bible says in chapter 42, verse 11, his network, his support system came to him and, quote, showed him sympathy and comforted him. We talked about those sons and daughters. Again, 10 new children, 7 sons, 3 daughters. Quote, in all the land there were no women so beautiful than those daughters. And then finally, we talked about this. Job lived another 140 years, saw 4 generations, and, quote, died an old man full of days. So if you could summarize the book of Job in one word, how would you do that? It's tough. I tend to think of the word why. In a lot of ways, we don't know. We don't know why. The mysteries of God, we don't know why. But it certainly is a book of perseverance, suffering, righteousness, the majesty of God. Why do bad things happen to good people? We still read this account and have a lot of the same questions than when we started. And let me just flash the lessons that I take away from this book. We don't have all the answers. Comfort those who suffer. Suffering should cause us to search for those answers, and the answer is always God. Maybe an obvious one, don't be like Job's friends. be like Job's friends at the very beginning of this story, but certainly not in the middle and the end. And then to trust God's wisdom and character no matter our circumstances. Of course, we got to bring it back to baseball. It's how we started. Life is an at-bat. We talked about persevering through a 13-minute, a 2-minute at-bat. Life's an at-bat. Our Christian walk is an at-bat. Our journey to heaven is an at-bat. Sometimes it's batter's count. Sometimes it's pitcher's count. But how do you react? When you're down 0-2, you're in the hole, a strikeout is imminent. How do you react? How did Job react when he was down 0-2? How do you react when you're up 3-0? Three balls, no strikes. You're happy. Success is there. Who do you give the glory to? Do you settle? Do you become complacent? The story of Job teaches me to stay grounded, to never compromise my faith, and to never underestimate the majesty and power of God. And I hope that's what you draw from it too. Thank you very much for your time.